This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. Welcome to The Literary Life. I want to tell you a story about something that actually happened. This is in the life of me as a bookseller. So I recently hurt my ankle, which has been causing me some difficulty in getting around and spending a lot of time in one store. So I've gone to visit the four stores that we have. And this actually happened in one day. I went over to our Coconut Grove store, and we have a wonderful bookseller there named Catherine. And Catherine, every once in a while, shows me a book that she's reading that she loves. And she goes to the stack that we have of this book, and she pulls it, she picks it up, points to it, and goes, "Boy, I didn't expect that this would be a book that would be for me, nor did I expect that it would be a book that would become the favorite book that I read all year." And the book is The Orchard by David Hopin. I then went to our Sunnyland store, and the bookseller there as well, I said, "What are you reading?" And she said, "I'm reading this amazing book. It's called The Orchard." I said, I've heard of it. And I then went up to Bal Harbour, which is a whole nother community. And the bookseller there happened to also, in his recommendation, had The Orchard too. And so in the three stores that I went to visit in one day, I was sold three copies of The Orchard, which is the novel, the first novel, by my guest today on The Literary Life, David Hopin. David, it's really true. You are turning the bookstore world upside down with this amazing first novel that you have written. So please welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate that. I appreciate that anecdote. I should note that having grown up in South Florida, I grew up in Hollywood, many a Sunday I would accompany my parents to the Bal Harbour shops, and I would sit in Books and Books while they were doing their thing. And I would, as I grew up, I would always think, if I ever had a book that got published, I know I made it if I would be talking to, you know, Books and Books. So for me, this is a dream come true moment. So thank you for having me.
Well, David, you're very, very welcome. And it's really exciting for us, you know, being a South Florida bookstore, to have kind of one of our own do something so very special. The very first thing I want to talk a little bit about, even before we talk about your book, is let's talk about you. So you have I read about what you're doing and what you've done. And as someone who was once that age and fiddled around while Rome burned, you certainly have not been sleeping your way through the very same years that I slept my way through. So tell me a little bit about right now. David's at Yale Law School, right, David? You're finishing your first semester there.
I'm finishing my first semester. I could probably use a bit more sleep at the moment. I'm in the curious and interesting experience of navigating both the book launch and final exams at the same time. You can't see it on this end, but if you could peek through the Zoom, you could see that my computer is being held up by a mountain of imposing textbooks. But I appreciate this, what I think is a wonderful learning study break, and great.
You know, not to mention, you're doing all of this in the midst of a pandemic as well.
In the midst of the
and an election.
It's been a weird year, but I'm very grateful for the different opportunities.
So, David, you also have your master's, and tell us a little bit about that. So, you went from one program to the next. So, Well, where did you get your master's and in what?
Right after graduating college, I went off to do my master's at Oxford, which was an extraordinary experience. My research focused on moral and legal theory, which is kind of how I, part of the reason my interests were solidified, and I went off to law school after. But my research was focused on thinking about how the Supreme Court formally adjudicates human dignity as a legal concept. I think this is something that gets into parts of my book, as we can discuss, but that was something that really engaged me, the idea that there's an interdisciplinary network between literature and the real tangible world of law, and thinking about law humanistically. A lot of my work centered on Emerson and his relationship with Justice Holmes. And so for me, there was a continuous coherence of thought amongst all my different interests. I was working on my book edits at the same time. And so a lot of my academic work, I think, sprinkled into the book a little bit. So I was off across the pond, and it was really a wonderful learning experience, cultural experience.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I was at Yale as an undergrad. So coming back to Yale for law school is a very lucky, magnificent opportunity. And it's like a little bit coming back to the place you love most. And somehow it's been, you know, a dystopian nightmare in between, because everything looks a little different right now. And you come to realize how important the lower hemisphere of someone's face is when you meet everyone for the first time, they're wearing a mask.
That's true.
But it's been, yeah.
You also learn how expressive the eyes can be, right?
Oh, yeah. They contain.
Did you study English at Yale? Is that what you studied?
I was an English major, but my work was really not creative writing. My work was more focused on the sort of theory I was doing in my master's. And so my creative writing was mostly on the side, independent of my coursework. Although when I was a junior, I had the wonderful once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study one-on-one with the great Susan Choi, who was on faculty. And so I had, you know, I had my prehistoric pages of the orchard at that point, and she was very influential in encouraging me to go on with the project. But yeah.
Susan was teaching an undergraduate creative writing course at the time.
She was, I believe teaching a course, and she also, there were some opportunities to do a one-on-one tutorial with her.
Oh, wow. That must have been what a treat.
That was an incredible experience.
She is so generous and such an amazing writer as well at the same time.
She's a brilliant writer, and she is an even more gracious and wonderful mentor. Very, very grateful for Susan.
So where did the writing bug begin? So it clearly began far before your time at Yale. So when did you know that was a path you were going to go down?
I think the writing bug first took hold. I was in, I believe, fourth grade, and we had these, our school would submit to the scholastic competitions. And I remember in a panic sending in a poem that was due the next day, and it ended up going off to the regional awards, and thinking, you know, maybe this writing thing is interesting. And I would go on as a kid. I read relentlessly, and I would fill binders with these epic fantasies and have my parents read them. And I was always writing. And I took it increasingly seriously in high school. And I actually started The Orchard beginning of my senior year. So I must have been 17, 18. And that's when I first had the idea for the book and sat down and started taking notes on characters and the overall trajectory.
So let's talk about The Orchard. So, why don't you tell us, explain the novel a little bit and give us a little bit of the background of it as well, if you can.
Absolutely.
Pardon my dogs, by the way.
No problem. So the Orchard basically transposes what I think is a very haunting and eerie myth from the Talmud, and sets it in modern times. So the myth from the Talmud is called Pardes. It features what are apparently the four holiest rabbis of their day, who enter into what's called an orchard, whatever that means, and come face to face with God. And each rabbi leaves irreversibly changed. One is unable to withstand divinity and dies, and another goes insane, and another is becomes a heretic, and the fourth leaves untouched. And so I was always taken with that myth. I thought it poses some interesting questions about what it means to form a religious identity, but more than that, what it means to form a civic identity. And so I used it as a jumping off point to examine the story of Ari Eden, who is this 18-year-old high school senior who finds himself abruptly rooted from his home in Brooklyn, New York, where he lives in a ultra-Orthodox community, and finds himself landing in South Florida unexpectedly, where things are a little more fast-paced and a little more modernized. And he falls into this group of friends who are ambitious and defiant and magnetic. And over the course of the story, this group begins conducting these unconventional and increasingly tragic moral experiments.
How much of Ari's story is reflected by your own experience as well? Did you come from an Orthodox family?
This is my world in some sense. Although I should note the book is entirely not autobiographical. The community depicted in the book bears little aesthetic or geographical resemblance to the community I grew up in. But what I did use as a jumping off point was the idea of this, what I think is an extremely fascinating and beautiful community within the American landscape that's sometimes neglected, especially in literature, which is modern Orthodox Judaism. And it's this very interesting balance between secular involvement and rigorous tradition. I went to yeshiva day schools my whole life, which meant that, for the first half of the day till 12 or 1 o'clock, you would be engaged in prayer and Judaic classes, and then you would go on to do your secular classes, and you have your basketball games after. And it, as a high school senior, I was thinking, this is first of all, this is quite an interesting world that I think is slightly different from the usual environment depicted in what I think was, the predominant Jewish American fiction culture. And second of all, I think given the dynamic of that world where, life and tradition find a way of inhabiting certain spheres together, it was a good ground to launch a reader into the territory that I wanted to go in, where you would have to take seriously questions of faith and philosophy.
Well, I think a lot of people do get confused. I mean, people look to the Orthodox community often, and they see images out of Williamsburg and the ultra-Orthodox, and they don't really understand that there's also a modern secular world that is also Orthodox. Describe a little bit the difference between the two.
I mean, in my opinion, I think the modern Orthodox vision can be summed up in what's called Torah Umada, which means Torah and science. It's the notion that Judaism and culture ought to heighten each other and not be imbalanced or in conflict. It's the idea that you can live a life structured on tradition and meaning without sacrificing involvement in the secular world. So for me, that was something that I felt was untapped. I think, there, especially nowadays, we see shows like Unorthodox, or we see shows that depict leaving the fold genre. And that was not what I set out to explore in this book. I think that the Jewish community is not homogenous, and I think there are interesting dynamics within it. And so I think that's what's at play in the book, more so than the typical, unorthodox, leaving the fold genre that we see a lot.
Yeah, what's really interesting to me is it isn't that. It isn't someone trying to escape something. It's really sort of a description and an attempt, a successful attempt, at drawing you into a world that I wasn't interested. I mean, I was interested in it, but I wasn't aware of it. Even though, I grew up as a Jewish kid on Miami Beach. It was not the world that I knew. I was much more familiar with a kind of more of a secular Judaism that might have been characterized as reform or something like that. But you just drew me into this world, you know, where it was riveting. And looking at some of the people who have written about your book, I was drawn to what Nathan Hill said about it, you know, who wrote The Knicks. And he said, I guess it would be accurate to call The Orchard a coming-of-age story, or a fish-out-of-water story, or a clash-of-culture story, or a crisis-of-faith story, or a false prophet story. The truth is, The Orchard is all of these and more. It's a story of profound intelligence, a story of tragic grandeur, and a story unlike any other I've ever read. That's quite remarkable, and it fits pretty much with everybody I've spoken to who've read this book. You've written a book that is so accomplished and so sophisticated, and you should be very proud of that. And you had to do it in between all of these other distractions that you had, school, life, being in your early 20s. So I imagine that this story must have been something that had gestated in you for quite some time.
I like to joke that I think is accurate. This is a coming of age story that came of age with me. These are characters who have inhabited permanent real estate in my head for a very long time. And that was actually a joy as someone writing this. This was something to which I turned during spare moments in between coursework or in between other life events. This was something that I was excited about constantly, increasingly so as the years went on and the prospect of putting it out there in the world became realer. It was a unique experience that I probably won't have again in writing a book, where you feel this attached to the story. I think it's not just because of when I wrote it, but I think it's because there's a certain time of your life that is depicted in this book. And I think when you're on the verge of adulthood and entering into young adulthood, things seem outsized and grand and majestic in a certain way. And so having The Orchard as my companion was really a phenomenal experience. And I think other projects I work on will probably be different, not necessarily less rewarding, but different.
Well, the reality testing of this novel was a little more simple for you. I mean, it was basically, you could say, is that the way I'm feeling right now? kind of thing. You know, I mean, it's really, really interesting. But did you have that dislocation in your life too? Did you go from Brooklyn to South Florida? Was that something that happened to you?
I can't say I did. I've born and raised in South Florida, so I never left. But I think that the idea of, you know, living in this kind of insulated community, going off for college to another place, gives you an opportunity to peer back and think, wow, this is a subculture of tremendous complexity and interest. And it allowed me to reimagine what it would be like to be an outsider. I think even when I started the book, I was always taken with the Nick Carraway Observer. And so I found that to be a good vehicle to get into the world of this Zion Hills, modern Orthodox, South Florida setting with renewed wonder, with fresh eyes. And that was through someone who could become dislocated. And I think a lot of the book in general, no matter which community the characters live in, it's about belonging and feeling part of something and finding what works for you instead of accepting, you know, state tradition. And so for me, that felt like a natural choice to use that kind of segue into the book.
Well, and also I think in the South Florida that I know, the Jewish culture here is so many faceted that you can experience everything that you experience in the book just right here in South Florida. So I think it's not hard to feel insular in whatever community you're in, right here in South Florida. So I assume you had things to compare your own experience with in other Jewish communities that were not as Orthodox, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I think South Florida presents a wonderful different melding of Jewish communities and non-Jewish communities, and it's just a vibrant place to grow up. And I think in terms of thinking about, I mean, there's some biblical components to this, but, in relative to New York or Brooklyn, I think South Florida presents itself as some sort of Eden in some ways, so to speak. And so I think there's some natural, obvious differences just in setting and in lifestyle and just general life that I think were interesting to play with when thinking about where I wanted to set this story.
So let's talk a little bit about what you intimated before, which was, and you deal with it in the novel, some of the moral complexity that you grew up thinking about, which has led you to where you are now, the complexity of law and philosophy and literature. Where do you fall on that right now? We've just been through this incredible political season, and your studying of the Supreme Court, you know, we've all been wondering exactly what was going to happen, you know, along those lines. So sort of tie it all together for me. What are some of the overriding thoughts you have, seeing what we've just been through in the context of your novel as well?
I mean, I think that in striking ways, the myth of the four rabbis neatly embodies a lot of the questions I'm interested in my academic coursework, and I think the country's interested in general. I think it gets into questions about what's the difference between being moral and being good. I think it questions about what does it mean to be worthy or to be decent or to be holy in a modern context. I think we have a lot of longing for transcendence in this country and in our personal lives. And I think all the more so given the current American landscape and current problems after COVID, I think these questions are particularly more acute. And not just by someone who's, you know, thinking about faith. I think someone who's thinking about what it means to inject a little more meaning in a life that's very much necessarily defined nowadays by repetition and, being trapped. So I think these are questions that in general are important to think about. I think they're guiding questions in the country now. I will say as a law student, I particularly enjoyed being able to think about the book in comparison with my work in school and vice versa, because I think being a fiction writer in law school, at least thus far, when you think about constitutional interpretation or theory, statutory text, you're not just playing with words that are there on the page to go through the motions. These words have a certain moral impact. The moral impact of language matters when what you do on the page translates into tangible things in real life and there are real human beings at stake. So I think thinking about law humanistically, like I said, I think that has been very important for me. I think anyone could benefit from that kind of cross-disciplinary analysis. And I think as a fiction writer, it's important to think about how words can do more than just stay on the page.
Yeah, well, no, I think humanistic is a word that I would apply to this novel. I mean, you know, that's what you're struggling with. That's what the characters are struggling with all throughout, is how to do the right thing, how to make the right choice. That is something that so many people have a real struggle with. And we've been seeing that in our body politic day in and day out with people not making that right choice. But it's just so infused in everything that you've written. It's interesting. I recently was reading a really interesting book that I pulled off my shelf. I must have had it for years. It was a book by Elie Wiesel, and he had written this book right after he had open heart surgery. And it was a kind of summing up of, he was in his 80s. He died a few years later. But it was so interesting to me because even a man of 82 was struggling with these very same issues. You know, have I done enough in my life, you know, that is good? Have I done enough to teach others about what's wrong? You know, all of these things are so infused in a moral life, and if you want to live a moral life.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting about your characters is that these were thoughts that they were having. These were discussions, and in the inner loop, that's what was going on. And you wonder about how many people don't have that inner loop. You know, right. How many people are not living their life with that kind of concern?
I think these are questions that consume anyone who's thinking, or perhaps should be consuming people, at least to some degree. I do think that this time period depicted in the book, this time of life when you're on the precipice of adulthood, but things have a funny way of ringing, ringing with a little more awe and wonder at that age. I think that inspires a lot of people who are thinkers to fall into the questions that end up haunting them for decades to come. And these are the questions you wrestle with for decades to come. And so I was interested in how that natural germination of thought would look like at someone at that age encountering these ideas, especially someone like Ari, the main character, who's hungry for experience and hungry for knowledge. The great Philip Roth, I'm not one to go against anything the great Philip Roth said, but I think he once remarked that fiction doesn't have to be a moral beauty contest, which of course is true. But I mean, I find my own fiction gravitating at least towards, doesn't have to be a beauty pageant, but thinking about moral beauty, I do think it'd be hard for me at least to write, given different interests I have and given the way the world looks, maybe the time I'm growing up, to write something where characters are not suffused with those thoughts and are not actively wrestling with how to make the right choices, how to be a good person. And what does it mean when you grow up in a place that speaks constantly and daily and every moment of time about religion and goodness? If you take seriously those ideas, as some of the characters do here, what do you end up with? Where does that lead you?
Talk about Evan a little bit. Talk about the character of Evan.
Yeah. I mean, as I'm sort of intimating, I think Evan is not just some defiant high schooler going through a phase. Evan is someone who has been marked in a deep sense by loss. Evan is someone who had recently lost his mother, with whom he was very close, someone who has an antagonistic relationship with his father. But he's also someone who is not just looking to lash out. He's someone who's looking to make sense of the world. And he is an intense thinker. He's extraordinarily well read. And he's someone who seems to be unhappy with leaving things unexamined. He's exposed to religion and through religion, certain ways of being whole again. And I think what Evan is looking out to do is how to make a fractured person whole again. I think all the characters in some ways that's an idea that they have to deal with or overcome, but I think for Evan, that's the most prominent.
Yeah. And then you have, that very charismatic rabbi who kind of, helps put everything in motion one way or another. How did that character come to be?
Rabbi Bloom, who's that character, was a character that once I started outlining him years ago, I was utterly taken with him. I like the idea of some sort of brilliant ethical conductor who would orchestrate deep thought experiments. I think there is a rich tradition of the Socratic professor, the charismatic entity who comes into your life and can engender almost a cultic following. And for students like Ari or Evan or their other friends who are filled with longing and also filled with ambition and intelligence and an energy to tie things together, Rabbi Bloom is a sort of savior figure for them, at least at the time when they meet him. And allowing the characters to go through that experience of being introduced to all the great works and all the great texts was something that I was excited about, and allowing the characters to come to a point where they'd have to make their own decisions about what you accept, what works for you. And when does a professor, when does a teacher become someone to whom you no longer have to look up? And when do you become your own independent person who makes decisions?
Yeah, and I don't want there to be any spoiler alerts here, but it has been likened to The Secret History as well by Donna Tartt. And I think it holds up with that comparison. So, you know, it becomes a compelling read as well. I don't want to give anybody the idea that it's just a philosophical, a series of philosophical discussions through the characters. But the other thing that I found really, really attracted me was the reverence that you had in a very essential way toward tradition and toward the notion of the shoulders we stand on. Even you did it even in your acknowledgments, where maybe you didn't really realize it. I mean, this is one of the more touching beginnings of an acknowledgement that I have read. And I'll just read you back your words a little bit. And I want to ask you a little bit about that. You wrote in you started your acknowledgments with, Yeats wanted to ground literature on the three things that Kant believed rendered life livable: freedom, God, immortality. To that list, I submit family, friends, and teachers, without each of whom this book could not exist. That gives me a sense of you. It also gives me a sense of the book. But you also really beautifully talk about the importance of your grandparents to you, and you, particularly your paternal grandparents, who I think had something to do with your literary awakening one way or another.
I would say all of my grandparents did. They read to me. I remember them would take me to Barnes and Nobles when we still had a local Barnes and Nobles in Hollywood. And my grandparents, all four of them, were avid readers and avid supporters of my work. They would read things I would write at a young age, elementary school. They would come to my those scholastic award ceremonies, and they would be cheering me on, whether they were in Florida or New York. My maternal grandfather is in the other room right now and waiting to hear after this interview. I mean, so I've been very blessed to be very close with my grandparents. And I would say my parents too were my original editors, my constant supporters. They have read every draft of this book from its very inception until now. They probably know it as well as I do. And so I'm very grateful to have had family who have not just supported me, but who have really had a constant, tangible presence in teaching me and in inspiring me. And I'll never be able to pay back that gratitude that I have for my family.
And I thank your parents for taking you to the bookshop when you were young. And even though we're meeting for the first time over Zoom, I feel incredibly proud of you as well. And I think a lot of South Florida writers do too. I saw this wonderful tweet from Brad Meltzer, who, I don't know if you know him personally, but he was extremely proud of the fact that you had this book coming out. And so many people are.
Thank you. Yeah, Brad Meltzer is, from the conversations I've had with him, just a wonderful, brilliant, receptive person. And he was encouraging of the whole writer and law student parallels.
Yeah.
And very supportive. I've been very grateful, especially for writers who, you know, speaking of standing on shoulders, who have supported me and given advice. And I think there's a genuine sense of warmth and happiness for debut writers, especially now in the pandemic. And I'm very grateful for all of that.
Well, I cannot wait to see the direction that your career takes. I know that this book is it's just been published. It was, I think the New York Times or someone said it was one of the most anticipated books of November. People out there are going to be hearing about it for a long time to come. And I hope when the physical world opens up a little bit more next year, when the paperback edition comes out, hopefully we can do something in the physical world for the book.
And I'd be very honored.
I look forward to it in a big, big way. Would you read a little bit from it so that people can get a sense of the flavor of it?
Absolutely. I think I'll just read a selection from the very beginning, which is the prologue, which gives sense of the atmosphere and texture of the world. Is tragedy dead? This is what I asked Mrs. Hartman at the end of it all, when I was still obsessed with every fatal flaw but my own. She didn't ask why I needed to know. Instead, she asked me to define tragedy for her. I told her this was impossible. Tragedy was a sub-philosophy, something to be felt, not defined. She shook her head. Majestic sadness, she told me. That's tragedy. I thought about that night, standing side by side with Evan and Amir in those waning moments before the policemen, the fire trucks, the body count. I thought about the look on Evan's suit-washed face. I wonder if Noah is seeing this, he had said, his voice soft, sad. After everything that had happened our senior year, it was the way he said this that made me cry. If that was not majestic sadness, I decided, nothing was. Well, Mr. Eden, she blinked at me. Did it die with the Greeks? No, I said, I suppose not.
Beautiful. That's a great setup. I hope everyone out there will pick up a copy of The Orchard. And since we're in the holiday season, it's a great holiday gift as well. But it's you should buy two, one for yourself and one to give. It is just a pleasure, David, to have you in The Literary Life. Thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you, Rob. Really an honor. Thank you.